Hello, and welcome to the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 16th, 2026. This is Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. We'll begin this first hour with a feature front page article from the Republic on water situation in Arizona. Then we'll move on to Valley and State news and conclude the first hour with national and world news with articles from USA Today. Our feature front page article for today is entitled Falling Water, and this is part one of two of a series of articles on the Colorado River nearing a critical point in the 30-year drought. This article is by Brandon Loomis. The mood darkened among Grand Canyon boat guides when Wayne Pullen stepped before them to share the news about their upcoming rafting season. No sense pretending that big flows were on tap. There's not enough water to fully power the West in this grimmest of drought years, and Pullen, a federal dam manager, made it clear as soon as he took the microphone at the gathering a short drive from the Lee's Ferry boat launch. He could spare less of the Colorado River than what typically propels rowers and clients through their geologic wonderland. The U.S. Bureau of Reclamation must reduce flows out of Glen Canyon Dam to protect its hydropower output and equipment, said Pullen, the agency's Upper Colorado Basin Regional Director, at the preseason training session organized by the nonprofit association Grand Canyon River Guides. Protecting the dam, he made clear, is top priority this year. The consequences would soon cascade from Wyoming through Utah, Arizona, and beyond. The mile-deep river chasm cutting through one of the nation's most visited parks would have to shoulder its share of the pain. Looking out at dozens of boatmen and boatwomen gathered on camp chairs in a dark equipment warehouse, he assured them he would give plenty of notice if he had to dial back releases to levels they have previously complained about, trickles that make the canyon's rapids especially rocky or bony. The flows, which can average up to 15,000 cubic feet per second in a good season, are likely instead to bounce between 6,000 and 9,000 in this one, Pullen told them. The numbers alarmed some in the crowd. A scientist who had been sitting by a guide who steers clients downriver on a large motorized raft later said, "You could sort of see the blood drain out of his head because it was like, oh man, this is going to be a summer of carnage." Pullen promised the early alert if his agency had to drop releases to 5,000 cubic feet per second, as it had done for 24 hours in 2023, prompting boater backlash. "I heard you loud and clear," he said of that response. "But this year's terrible hydrology can't be helped," he said. "We're in tough sledding," Pullen said, using a recreational metaphor that calls to mind the crux of the problem, skimpy snow cover. That would be the Rocky Mountain snow that in most springs melts in volumes that swell the Colorado, that raise Lake Powell against the dam, that turn the turbines to help power millions of homes, that supply southwestern farms and cities, and that jet thousands of thrill seekers through the rapids in one of the world's most revered natural wonders. That snow was a virtual no-show in the winter of 2025-2026. Hopes for a summer of plenty melted away with its remnants. Stuff we've never seen. The Colorado Basin River Forecast Center released a forecast in June predicting that the April-July snowmelt runoff season would end as the driest on record with just 15% of the average. Later in the summer, Reclamation updated the actual flows and indicated that the season total had improved slightly and would just sneak past 2002's to instead make it the second worst on record. Still, reservoir levels were much higher in 2002's record low flow. Much of the watershed experienced the warmest and least snowy winter on record, according to the Forecast Center, which is part of the National Weather Service. It's only the latest in a long string of bad news for an arid region that has grown warmer and drier throughout the 21st century, bringing Lake Powell to the brink. The Bureau of Reclamation and the farmers it supplies measure water in massive volumes called acre feet, or the amount it would take to cover an acre to a depth of 1 foot. Most of the water comes from the Rocky Mountains and other points upstream of Lee's Ferry, a key flow gauging station where the first riffles below Glen Canyon Dam hint at roller coaster waves awaiting in the Grand Canyon. The natural flow, a term for what likely would pass Lee's Ferry if not for the dam and other impoundments above it, averaged 15.2 million acre-feet in the 20th century, according to Brad Udall, a climate research scientist at Colorado State University's Colorado Water Center. In this century so far, it has averaged just 12 million. The difference adds up to 80 million acre-feet over the 27 years since the reservoir last oscillated near capacity in the 1990s. A volume of lost water since 2000 that could have filled Lake Powell's storage capacity more than three times over. The average yearly flow during the worst 27-year period of the 20th century was more than a million acre-feet higher than during this mega drought. The last 7 years have been bleaker still, averaging just 10.2 million acre-feet. Even stacked against the worst 7-year stretch of the 20th century, the last seven have brought an annual deficit of 1.7 million, a loss that's more than five times the water that Phoenix, America's fifth largest city, supplies to its customers. "These are all really big differences, right?" Udall said. "Stuff we've never seen." The Colorado River Basin is warming at a rate of 3 degrees Celsius per century, Udall said, compared with a global average rate of 2 degrees. Each degree Celsius is expected to reduce Colorado River flows by another 9% from increased evapotranspiration, he said, citing 2020 research by U.S. Geological Survey scientists published in Science magazine. The prospects have trained interstate relations along the river and led to conflict over water allocations. The seven states who share the river's wealth must also share in its diminishing returns. For now, at least, they have failed to reach a deal that would protect reservoir levels in times of severe shortage, times like these. The lower basin states of Arizona, California, and Nevada, which support the bulk of the population and farm production, use the majority of water and have agreed to take the first and largest hit. But they have insisted that in the driest years, the upper basin states of Colorado, New Mexico, Utah, and Wyoming must also impose mandatory cuts on users, which those states have resisted. Upper basin states already have to close off some irrigation ditches when tributary streams don't have enough water to supply all local farmers. The lower basin argues this isn't sufficient conservation because it merely shuffles local sources among users according to in-state priorities. It doesn't send more of that water downstream to Lake Powell and the Southwest. The impasse leaves it to federal reclamation officials, answering to Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, to piece together at least a short-term plan to impose this fall. A plan they released this summer allows for up to 3 million acre-feet of reductions in use among the lower basin states over the next decade. Despite ever-worsening conditions, Udall is optimistic that the states will eventually reach a deal, he said, because they must. "We have a very unique opportunity here to redo a system that's been in place for 100 years, he said. "We can redo it for maybe the next 25 or 50 years. It likely will require buying out users," Udall said, "a difficult prospect, but one that will make everyone happier in the end. That likely means paying farmers to stop or reduce their irrigating, as more than three-quarters of the river's flow supplies agriculture." "We've got a much smaller glass right now," Udall said. "We've got too many straws in it, and we need to pull straws out of this glass." Crisis at the Glen Canyon Dam. The immediate crisis is the threat to Glen Canyon Dam and the many suburban and rural power consumers who depend on it. Having dropped more than 170 feet over a parched quarter century, Lake Powell's waterline, as summer started, loomed just 37 feet above what Reclamation considers minimum power pool, the point at which the dam's turbines shut down. That would be unprecedented, since the spiraling generators encased in the slab of 4.9 million cubic yards of concrete cranked out their first electrons in September 1964. Forecasts had suggested it was likely by fall if Pullen's agency didn't enact emergency measures. Below minimum power pool, the only option to keep the river flowing is to release water around the clock through bypass tubes that were not built for full-time work and could fail and blow out surround rock under the strain. To prevent such a calamity, at least for this year, Pullen said the government is draining water out of the much smaller Flaming Gorge Reservoir, which straddles the Wyoming-Utah state line on the Green River, the Colorado's largest tributary. Dam managers also intend to substantially cut back on flows from Glen Canyon Dam through Grand Canyon, a move that will push an already diminished Lake Mead lower against Hoover Dam, reducing its own capacity to generate power. Some of the guides listening on at their late March gathering told the Arizona Republic they worried that the low flows would deter Pullen's agency from blasting water through the bypass tubes to churn up sand from the riverbed and deposit it on banks where it can rebuild eroded camping beaches and sandbars, among numerous natural components of Grand Canyon that dam construction has warped by blocking springtime deluges. Planned floods out of the dam, called high-flow experiments, or HFEs, are supposed to happen whenever a set amount of sand accumulates downstream of the dam, as it has this year. Despite that prescription, which stems from the Grand Canyon Protection Act of 1992, Reclamation has skipped several floods in recent years when adequate sand had built up to trigger one. At the time, Pullen was still weighing his options, but confided that it could be tough to open the floodgates in a year when the water behind the dam offers so little room for error. "We will make the case for doing a high-flow experiment," he said. "High-flow experiments are important, and I hate the fact that I am the guy who didn't do high-flow experiments." Though he pledged to try, he hinted that the dry year might make it difficult to justify bypassing Glen Canyon Dam's power plant to create such a deluge to aid Grand Canyon's environment and recreation. "Water is the fuel that runs everything," Pullen told the Arizona Republic. "Low water leads to hard choices." In June, Pullen would announce with disappointment that he again must pull the plug on a beach-building flood. Rowers, anticipating a season of gullied or even unusable camps, listened with exasperation to Pullen's talk. Some said the succession of skipped HFE floods, even when tributaries had dumped sufficient sand below the dam, detracted from natural conditions and created hazards as flash floods continue to cut through what's left of the beaches. "An HFE is the law," longtime river guide Zeke Locke said. "A lot of us feel there are too many loopholes." But river runners constitute one of Colorado's smaller constituencies. Many more Westerners count on the water for affordable energy. And Pullen noted that the Trump administration has made clear it is prioritizing energy and economics, such as with the 2025 People Over Fish executive order. Even before drought completely powers down the dam's turbines, the reduced pressure and water bypassed for environmental purposes like maintaining endangered fish has cut into production and forced utilities, including the one in the neighboring dam town of Page, to spend more to import electricity from costlier generators on the grid. Page historically got about half of its power from the dam, but now gets closer to 20%, Page Utility General Manager Brian Hill said. In response, the City Council in 2023 approved a rate increase of 20% for residential customers and 40% for commercial customers. Those rates, both at approximately 8 cents per kilowatt hour, remain bargains at less than half the national average price of residential power. But it likely won't be the last increase if another dismal winter snowpack drops Lake Powell below minimum power pool next year. That means power costs will go higher for us, Hill said, and that's going to be a lot of entities in Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, Arizona. Anybody that gets power from the Colorado River Storage Project system, they're going to have to replace that power. So it's going to have to be made up with generally fossil generation. Propping up hydropower production already is causing ripple effects up and down the river, affecting other resources, including the environment, recreation, and, looming biggest of all as states and water users fight over worsening shortages, the ability to keep pushing water to the farms, cities, and 40 million residents who rely on it from Denver to Los Angeles, from Salt Lake City to Mexicali. This water is wealth in the desert Southwest, Hill said. This situation is dire. Watching it drain away. Sagebrush and sand bound the inlet at Buckboard Wash, a wrinkle in southwest Wyoming's Green River Valley flooded by the water that Flaming Gorge impounds more than 40 miles downstream in Utah. On the walls inside Buckboard Marina's office and restaurant, trophies of bright red Kokanee salmon and fat speckled lake trout wordlessly tell the remote outpost's reason for being. These coveted sport fish, made possible in the Wyoming steppe only by the reservoir's artificially cold depths, attract thousands of boat anglers from all over the West. That is, they do unless those anglers get the idea there won't be enough water to fish or to dock their boats. Already I'm getting the phone calls. People who are supposed to show up in 2 weeks, marina owner Jen Valdez said in late April, when 43 empty dock slips awaited traffic. She tells them that the fishing is likely to get better before things deteriorate too much, as happened last time reclamation opened up the dam to aid Lake Powell in 2022. The fish then got more concentrated, easier to target, she said. Eventually, though, it became difficult for her family to keep the docks wet as the shoreline receded and toxic algal bloom surged in the shallower lake. We had a lot of cancellations, Valdez said. This spring, she had resigned herself to another tough summer, though she doubted anyone would consider the trade-off worthwhile in the long run. Flaming Gorge, with a maximum capacity of 3.5 million acre-feet, can only do so much for a Lake Powell that was built to hold 23 million acre-feet, but now contains less than 6 million. And with reclamation aiming to send up to 1 million acre-feet downstream to Powell this year, Flaming Gorge will have that much less to contribute if the snowpack doesn't rebound this winter. An acre-foot is roughly 326,000 gallons, enough to supply a few southwestern households for a year. But even sending a million of them from Flaming Gorge and holding back 1.48 million from Lake Mead were only projected to keep Lake Powell about 10 feet above minimum power pool by next April, according to the Bureau of Reclamation. I just think it's sad that they're going to potentially ruin other places without really being able to save Lake Powell anyways, Valdez said. The infusion is a boost for the town of Page on Lake Powell, though, where the Chamber of Commerce has had to fight impressions that there's not enough water for economic mainstays like houseboat, kayak, and fishing vacations. True, the National Park Service has closed most of the lake's boat ramps as the water retreats past the concrete, but the on-lake attractions remain. A lot of people are feeling that there isn't any water in the lake. That is not true. There is, said Judy Franz, the Page Lake Powell Chamber's executive director. We are low. We probably will not get a huge runoff this year, but we've been there before. And what we find is that we just have to work around it. Her husband, charter bass fishing guide Bill McBurney, said business remained strong this spring, and he was turning away some customers. There's plenty of fishing at the current 1,700 miles of shoreline, he said, even if that's less than the 2,000 miles when the reservoir is full. If the reservoir drops below the turbine intakes, he said, we always have a lake. Fighting over cutbacks on river. Part of the reason that states can't agree is that neither the upper basin or lower basin believes it is getting what it was promised by an interstate compact they all signed in 1922. The upper basin has never fully used the share that the 1922 Colorado River Compact awarded it, and its negotiators argue that it is climate change, not their use, that has depleted the river and threatened the share that the compact promised to the lower basin. Absent a deal, Arizona in particular and the lower basin in general have threatened to sue to force the upper basin to provide the volume of water that the compact prescribes past Glen Canyon Dam and Lee's Ferry. Whatever short-term shortage rules the federal government imposes in lieu of a negotiated deal will likely lean heavily on restricting lower basin use. That is in part because a 20th century Supreme Court ruling gave the Interior Secretary water master powers there that he is not known to enjoy in the upper basin. Reclamation's rules could, however, continue with emergency releases from Flaming Gorge. A chat between two of the state negotiators, one from each basin, at a University of Colorado forum in early June put some of the brinkmanship on public display. Southern Nevada Water Authority General Manager John Ensminger warned that if the upper basin won't act to ensure that the lower basin gets its share, it invites a lawsuit from the lower basin states. Such a case could result in the courts granting Interior the same power to enforce cuts in the upper basin, he said, same as the previous ruling imposed on the lower basin. If the upper basin wants to roll the dice that the Interior Secretary becomes the water master in the upper basin, he said, that's one of the risks they're running in not reaching agreements. Colorado's lead negotiator replied that federal control should be a backstop, not a primary strategy. The states need to collaborate on adapting to their new water reality so that federal authority isn't necessary, Colorado River Commissioner Becky Mitchell said. But the dire situation in the mountains and the reservoirs isn't helping as the worsening shortage dials up the stakes. The constant kind of threat of the federalization reflects the reality that as hydrology worsens, consensus is harder to come by, Mitchell said. Udall, the climate scientist, spoke at the same conference and begged the upper basin states to join the lower basin in cutbacks. It's understood that there's always pain in the mountain states because they don't have the Southwest's big reservoirs and they must curtail farmers when headwater streams run dry, he said, but more action is needed. If snowpack trends continue, standing pat in the upper basin could mean that those states use more than half of the river in the future, he said. We need everybody with a shoulder to this wheel, Udall said. Yeah, upper basin, you didn't cause this. You can make that case, but yeah, you're part of the problem. One Colorado River expert believes that whatever happens between the states, eventually, they'll need congressional approval to allow farms in one state to sell to cities in another, something that's currently both prohibited and taboo. We've got to create a system where you can market and sell water across the basin so that Phoenix and Central Arizona has the ability to go to the upper basin and say, if you retire your water rights in Basin X in Wyoming or the Yampa Basin in Colorado, we're going to move that water down to us at the Central Arizona Project, said Jack Schmidt, who leads the Center for Colorado River Studies at Utah State University. The Central Arizona's project is the federally authorized canal that pumps water from the lower Colorado River to the Phoenix and Tucson areas. Its leaders have sounded the alarm that if federal cuts are imposed only on the lower basin, it could lead to the canal going dry and force cities to rely on groundwater and local supplies like the Salt and Verde Rivers. These sources already account for substantial use in central Arizona, though Phoenix draws more than a third of its water from the Colorado, and some suburbs are still more reliant on it. The stakes are immense to the state of Arizona, Schmidt said. The stakes are kind of significant to the upper basin, but the reality is the upper basin is trying to hold on to the possibility of future development, while the state of Arizona is trying to hold on to the actual water use that they depend on right now. And the fact that they can agree and come to a mutual agreement on what's in the best interest of the country is an enormous problem. Longer term, he said, the most fundamental need across the watershed is to incentivize agricultural efficiency or change an allocation system that allows half of the river to be consumed just for livestock feed. Meantime, the role that Colorado River dams play in the region's electric grid is necessarily on the wane, Schmidt said. The future of hydropower is really going to be much more minimal, he said. And that article is entitled Falling Water, and that was by Brandon Loomis. We're going to move on now to Valley and State News with this next article entitled Couple Buried Behind Their Litchfield Park Home Worked in Healthcare and Higher Ed. This is by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. Hector and Larissa Flores, the husband and wife found buried behind their Litchfield Park home, worked in healthcare and higher education, according to their employers. Larissa Flores worked for Circle the City, a nonprofit that provides healthcare to people experiencing homelessness in Maricopa County. Hector Flores was an associate professor of management and human resources at Cal Poly Pomona in Southern California. The couple was found buried in the backyard of their Litchfield Park home on August 6th, with an international manhunt underway to find their son, who is believed to be the killer. Here's what we know about Hector and Larissa Flores. Who was Larissa Flores? Circle the City described Larissa Flores as a cherished member of the organization who treated patients with compassion, warmth, and dignity every single day, said Director of Marketing and Communications Hunter Scott in a statement. Her impact will be felt for years to come, Scott said. Who was Hector Flores? Cal Poly Pomona's College of Business Administration told faculty in an email that Hector Flores, an associate professor of management and human resources, had died. Flores joined Cal Poly Pomona in 2015 and taught strategic management, senior project, and internship courses, according to the email. He also served on university committees and represented faculty through the California Faculty Association. Flores had taught last spring semester and was scheduled to teach this fall, the email said. Before entering academia, Flores spent more than a decade with International Paper and held leadership positions, including as general manager of Temple Inland in Phoenix, according to the email. His faculty page said he had more than 25 years of management experience with a Fortune 100 company, including work as president and general manager. What happened at the home? Avondale police identified Hector and Larissa Flores on August 11th after investigators found two bodies buried behind their home during an investigation that began with an August 4th welfare check. Their causes and manners of death remained pending, according to the Maricopa County Medical Examiner's Office. Police identified their son, Matthew Christopher Flores Semyonov, as a suspect. The U.S. Marshals Service is leading an international search for him. A wanted notice shared by the Marshals Service includes a photo of Flora Semyonov that the service says was taken August 3rd, one day before Avondale police conducted the welfare check that began the investigation. Anyone with information regarding Flora Semyonov's location is urged to contact the U.S. Marshals 24-hour tip line at 1-877-WANTED-2 or submit a tip through the agency's TIPS app or at a www.usmarshals.gov/tips website. Tips can be submitted anonymously. And that article was entitled couple buried behind their Litchfield Park home worked in healthcare and higher ed. That was by Ray Covarrubias, Jr. We're almost 30 minutes past the hour in this first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 16th, 2026. Continuing with Valley and State News, this next article is entitled San Carlos Apache Tribe to Receive Aid for Flooding. This is by Deborah Utasia Kroll. The Federal Emergency Management Administration has approved a disaster declaration for the San Carlos Apache Tribe to support recovery from flooding nearly a year ago. The declaration covers the tribal reservation for both physical and economic damages suffered from October 10th through 13th, 2025, and within the contiguous counties of Apache, Gila, Graham, Greenlee, Navajo, and Pinal for assistance from the Small Business Administration. In addition, the SBA is offering low-interest disaster recovery loans to tribal members and businesses. Fred Koenig, a public affairs specialist with the SBA, said his agency and FEMA conducted a joint operation to assess the four most hard-hit communities of Gilson Wash, 7 Mile, Peridot, and Bilas. He said applications for loans due to physical damage had been extended until September 30th. Loans for economic injury are due no later than March 1st, 2027. Those loans are designed to help businesses, agricultural cooperative, or private nonprofits close funding gaps due to disasters. Recipients can borrow up to $2 million for business expenses like payroll, inventory, rent, and utilities, according to SBA. Koenig said business owners in the contiguous counties can also apply for economic injury loans due to the flooding. "The loans have pretty good terms," Koenig said. "There are no fees or penalty for early payments. Interest rates vary from 3 to 4% for applicants who have no other credit access, to 3.625% to 8% for entities with credit available elsewhere." Kevin Casador, San Carlos Tribal Emergency Readiness Council head, said to date, FEMA officials had approved $600,000 for direct aid to 97 recipients, with another 108 in progress. These funds, unlike the SBA loans, do not require repayment. As of August 1st, about a dozen applications for damage or economic injury had been submitted. More are likely to be submitted before the loan deadlines. Casador said it took the feds 8 months to approve San Carlos's request. The FEMA officials who met with San Carlos leadership could not say why the tribe's request had been approved while Globe's was not. But he said it might have been due to the lower threshold the tribe had compared to local communities. "We're still concerned because tribal members live there," Casador said. "Businesses the tribe does business with and where tribal members shop were also affected." The state approved $10 million for flood damage recovery in the Globe, Miami area and Gila County in its 2027 budget. Tribes were authorized to make their own request for a presidential emergency or major disaster declaration in 2013. Previously, they were required to join with the state to ask for disaster assistance from feds. To learn more or to start the loan application process, visit SBA's disaster site or call 800-659-2955. And that article is entitled San Carlos Apache Tribe to Receive Aid for Flooding. That was by Deborah Utasia Kroll. Our next article is entitled Goodyear Officer Accused of Misusing Flock System. This is by David Uoa, Jr. A Goodyear police officer was placed on administrative leave after investigators found that he may have improperly used an automated license plate reader, according to an August 11th statement released by the Goodyear Police Department. The statement comes a day after an Apache Junction police officer resigned for misusing his department's Flock automated license plate reader technology. The Goodyear officer was placed on administrative leave on July 22nd, after investigators at the Goodyear Police Department audited their Flock system activity on July 21st, according to the statement. During their audit, investigators found that there was a potential criminal violation, according to the department's statement. Authorities did not name the officer. The Glendale Police Department was overseeing the criminal investigation. Goodyear Police Department requested an outside law enforcement agency conduct the criminal investigation. The department will continue its investigation into the potential misuse of its flock system after the Glendale Police Department finishes its investigation. Goodyear Police Department currently operates 33 flock automated license plate reader cameras. There has been a nationwide outcry against automated license plate readers, especially those made by flock. Critics have cited lack of transparency, privacy violations, and immigration authorities requesting local partners to conduct searches on its behalf. Tempe stopped participating in Flock's national data sharing program, but is still using its license plate readers. Chandler ceased its contract with the company on August 7th. Our auditing process did exactly what it is intended to do. It identified activity that warranted further review, and we acted immediately, Goodyear Police Chief Brian Issett said in a written statement. Goodyear Police Department released information about its automated license plate reader policies, auditing practices, and the ongoing investigation in the interest of transparency, the statement said. And that article was entitled, Goodyear Officer Accused of Misusing Flock System. That was by David Uoa Jr. This next article is entitled, Homeless Couple Accused of Selling Stolen Library Books. This is by Elena Santa Cruz. An unhoused couple was accused of stealing thousands of dollars worth of Mesa Public Library books and trying to resell them to a used bookstore to make money, according to police and court records. On May 19th, staff at the city's Red Mountain branch told police they learned a woman was trying to sell public library books at Half Price Books, a used bookstore near Superstition Springs Boulevard and Southern Avenue. Staff from the bookstore reached out to the library after Ian Bartlett, 36, and Athena Bartlett, 33, came to the store to sell 19 books with Mesa Public Library labels and barcodes, according to court records. Bookstore staff told the couple they could not complete the sale after noticing the public library labels. The pair then made their way out, leaving the books on the counter, the court record said. A Mesa library staffer went to the store to retrieve the books, which were determined to be checked out to Ian Bartlett, according to court records. Investigators learned of other attempts to sell books. Half Price Books shared 5 transaction receipts that showed Athena Bartlett had sold 423 books between May 7th and May 14th, court records said. Library staff found 2 library accounts under Ian, one of which had been blocked because $1,565 worth of books were never returned. The second account was created on April 2nd and had 66 books outstanding, 19 of which were returned by Half Price Books. Those were checked out by Ian and were not yet due, according to court records. Athena also had an account and had numerous books checked out, court records said. Between their accounts, Mesa library officials said about $6,287 in books were outstanding, court records said. The two returned to the library on August 7th, according to library staff, who said they saw Athena on camera taking books without checking them out and leaving with Ian. They came back again on August 10th, and library staff called police, who arrested the couple. In a post-arrest interview, the couple told police they went to various libraries because they were homeless and would knowingly check out books and sell them to half-price books for money, according to court records. Both were booked on suspicion of trafficking in stolen property and theft. Those who think they may have unknowingly purchased or have a Mesa Public Library book that could be connected to the investigation were asked to contact the police department, according to Detective Jose Aguirre, a police spokesperson. And that article was entitled, Homeless Couple Accused of Selling Stolen Library Books. That was by Elena Santa Cruz. This next article is entitled Teens Arrested After Police Warn About Student-Led Game. This is by Elena Santa Cruz. High schoolers have been donning floaties to avoid being eliminated by the blast of a water gun in a student-led game called Senior Assassins for years. But this school year, days after Queen Creek police warned the public about the possible legal consequences of participating in the game, two teens playing the game were arrested and accused of disorderly conduct. Senior Assassins is not a school-sponsored activity. Students, typically seniors, use water guns or other means to eliminate other students in public, including parks, restaurants, shopping centers, and neighborhoods. Items such as floaties or goggles typically serve as a shield from being targeted in public. On August 6th, the police department said in a social media post that they do not endorse or encourage participation in the game. The post said police officials were aware that students may play the game now that a new school year had begun. Parents and guardians were urged to speak to their teens about the risks involved and to ensure their participation does not lead to unsafe situations, cause public harm, or result in legal consequences. Police reminded the public not to use water guns that resembled firearms, show water guns off in a threatening or disorderly manner, trespass on private property, play in business areas, run into streets or traffic, drive recklessly, or play around moving vehicles. The message didn't appear to reach some people. 2 days later, about 10 p.m., police responded to reports of people with a gun at the In-N-Out Burger near Ellsworth and Rittenhouse Roads, according to Police Chief Randy Bryce. There were no reports of injuries or shots fired, Price said. Police swiftly responded and found that two 17-year-olds with water guns were participating in the game, Bryce said. One was wearing a cloth-type mask, Bryce said. Both were arrested and the investigation was still ongoing, Bryce said. The incident occurred 1 week after police in Idaho said a man with Arizona ties went on a shooting rampage at a newly opened In-N-Out. Three people died and seven people were injured. And this article is entitled Teens Arrested After Police Warn About Student-Led Game, and that was by Elena Santa Cruz. This next article is entitled Suspect in Gold and Silver Theft Made Getaway to Arizona. This is by Ray Stern. An Ontario, Canada woman accused of stealing a FedEx package in Pennsylvania containing about $44,000 in gold and silver made her getaway by flying to Arizona. Authorities don't know what the woman did after arriving at Phoenix Sky Harbor International Airport on May 11th, but she's been in jail since July 5th when she attempted to cross into Canada from New York. Records don't indicate she had the gold and silver in her possession during the arrest. But the victim, who isn't being named in this article, said he had insured the contents with the company that sold him the precious metals, Apex, and he was fully reimbursed. Police in Bensalem Township went to see Kaylee Hogan, who's 25, charged with three felony counts, including theft by deception, theft by unlawful taking, and forgery. The victim had been tracking the package due to its high value on May 11th and received a text alert just after 1 p.m. that the package was delivered, according to a probable cause affidavit obtained by the Arizona Republic from the Bucks County Magisterial District Court of Judge Michael Gallagher. Yet the victim hadn't signed for the package as required. His daughter was down the street on her way home and later said she saw a black-haired woman wearing all black clothes standing next to a black sedan and a FedEx truck. The FedEx driver later told police the woman blocked his truck with her car, approached him, claimed the package was hers, and signed for it using the victim's last name, the affidavit states. Police soon figured out the car had been rented at the Philadelphia International Airport by Hogan, the affidavit states. After obtaining the package, Hogan dropped off the rental car at the airport and flew to Charlotte, North Carolina, then to Phoenix. And that article is entitled Suspect in Gold and Silver Theft Made Getaway to Arizona. That was by Ray Stern. We're going to move on now to national and world news with articles from USA Today. We've got two front page articles. The first is on Iran, and the second is on grocery prices and Trump. The first article is entitled, Iran Remains Defiant Over Strait of Hormuz. The subtitle is, Peace Talk Progress, Oil Tanker Traffic Both Halted. This is by Iman Abu Hasira, Inas Al-Ashray, and Humaira Pamuk. Iran called on the United States to accept defeat on August 15th, while President Donald Trump blasted Tehran as very evil and told Americans to prepare for continued high fuel prices as a result of the war. Progress toward peace talks and oil tanker traffic through the strategic Strait of Hormuz remain halted, with no sign the warring parties were moving toward ending the conflict that the United States and Israel launched on February 28th. This strait will be opened and closed only under Iran's command, and so long as you do not accept the reality of defeat and stop indulging in fantasies, Iran will continue to enforce the blockade, Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Qasem Gharibabadi posted on X. Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Iran had not decided to resume talks with the United States. He told Iranian news outlet Sharara News in an interview published on August 15th that Washington must meet conditions on the strait in order for shipping to resume in the waterway that handled one-fifth of the world's oil before the war. Trump urged Americans to accept slightly higher gasoline prices while the conflict continues. He told a political rally in Garden City, New York on August 14th that paying a tiny little bit more for your gasoline is worth the cost of ensuring a very evil country would not have a nuclear weapon, one of his stated rationales for the war. After we finish defeating Iran, pretty soon I'll be declaring the Hormuz Strait a territory of the United States, Trump said. Throughout the conflict, the president has alternated between threats of escalation and assertions that a peace deal is imminent. In a trend that has sparked inflation and disappointed voters, the average U.S. price of a gallon of gasoline was about $4.08 on August 14th, up 29% from a year earlier, according to AAA. Trump, a Republican, campaigned for re-election on a promise to lower energy costs, and Democrats are seeking to make the war's fallout an issue in November congressional elections. Benchmark Brent futures were on track for a weekly rise of 6% and West Texas Intermediate 5.4%. Tehran, too, has stepped up its rhetoric in recent days as attempts to bring a permanent end to the war appeared deadlocked. The Strait of Hormuz cannot be seized by tweet or an aircraft carrier, by issuing an order, or by delivering an election speech, Gharibabadi said. Despite Iran's defiant tone, though, there were also signs of an economic toll there. President Masoud Pezeshkian, in remarks on state television, blamed high inflation on a U.S. blockade of Iranian ports and sanctions on Iran's oil exports. No oil vessels transiting strait. Trump and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent each pledged to inflict more financial damage on Iran. Bessent told Newsmax's Rob Schmidt Tonight program on August 13th that announcements of more measures against Iran were coming in the days ahead. Tehran calls its enforcement of strait traffic a blockade, the term Washington uses for its threat against Iranian vessels leaving their ports. What we're doing is a great service for the world, not only for ourselves, and we're really doing a great job, Trump said. Only two vessels passed through the Strait of Hormuz on August 14th, with no crude oil shipments visible, according to analysis from ship tracking firm Kepler. Some ships may cross the strait undetected with their transponders off, but the figures are nowhere near the more than 130 ships that traversed it daily before the war. Vessels that dare navigate the strait without Iranian permission risk missile or drone strikes. The United Arab Emirates accused Iran of attacking a third vessel operated by Abu Dhabi National Oil Company that was transiting the strait on August 14th, the Emirati state news agency WAM reported, after blaming it for two other incidents involving ADNOC vessels in the strait late on August 13th. The United Kingdom Maritime Trade Operations Center reported a bulk carrier was struck in the hull by an unknown projectile in the strait on August 14th. It was not immediately clear if it was referring to the same incident involving the ADNOC vessel. A tentative June deal to end the war is in tatters. We did not have a ceasefire in the first place that we would now want to extend, Arachi said. We had the end of the war, and now there is a new situation. Attacks by Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen renewed concerns about a widening regional war. Yemen's internationally recognized government said the Houthis fired six ballistic missiles at the Red Sea port of Mocha on August 14th, killing four civilians. And that article is entitled, Iran Remains Defiant Over Strait of Hormuz. That was by Emin Abu Husira, Anas Al-Ashri, and Humaira Pamuk. Our next front page article from USA Today is entitled, Grocery Issue Flips for Trump. The subtitle is, 2024 Photo Op Shows Gap of Promise, Reality. This is by Nathan Lane. 2 years after Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump staged a New Jersey news conference flanked by grocery staples to spotlight inflation under Democrats, food prices are still rising despite his pledge to bring them down. The gap between promise and reality now looms as a vulnerability for Republicans ahead of November's midterm elections. Standing between tables piled high with fruit, beef, cereal, milk, and other household staples at his Bedminster Golf Club on August 15, 2024, Trump blamed the Biden administration for sharp increases in grocery prices. The spectacle, complete with charts showing higher prices, was aimed at undercutting the Democratic nominee, Kamala Harris, and highlighted Trump's central promise. He alone could tame inflation and lower the cost of living. 2 years on, higher gasoline and grocery prices are squeezing household budgets and turning the cost of living into the top issue for American voters. Voters now give Democrats a slight edge over Republicans in who they view as better stewards of the economy for the first time in nearly a decade, according to a Reuters Ipsos polling. Sheila Carney, a 68-year-old Trump voter, punctuated her frustration with an expletive as she unloaded $70 worth of groceries into her car outside a supermarket not far from Trump's Bedminster Club. The haul was modest, some meat, detergent, and a 12-pack of iced tea. For Carney, the receipt was evidence that the affordability concerns Trump has sometimes dismissed as a Democratic hoax remain a daily burden for many Americans. This is real. He can say it's not, but it is, said Carney, a hospital administration assistant who has delayed retirement while helping pay off her son's student loans. He hasn't brought anything down. A Reuters analysis of 26 grocery categories tracked by the Bureau of Labor Statistics and featured in Trump's Bedminster display found prices have risen 3.4% in the first 19 months of his second term. That's less than a quarter of the pace recorded at the same point in former President Joe Biden's term, but still falls short of Trump's pledge to lower prices, as surges in coffee, beef, and apples have more than offset declines in items including eggs and butter. A White House official pointed to data on August 12th that showed U.S. consumer prices barely increased in July from the month before as evidence that inflation is under control. The July CPI report is further proof that President Trump's long-term agenda is delivering. Prescription, drug, and auto insurance costs continue to fall, real wages are rising, and beef prices have cooled while other household essentials like eggs, poultry, and dairy remain low, the official said. Lack of enthusiasm. A registered Republican, Carney said high grocery and gasoline prices due to the Iran war were among the reasons she had grown disillusioned enough to consider sitting out the midterms, underscoring recent polling suggesting Republicans are less enthusiastic about voting than Democrats. Carney was one of 17 Republicans and independents Reuters interviewed in New Jersey's 7th Congressional District, a battleground that includes Bedminster and where swing voters and turnout could prove decisive. The race pits Republican incumbent Tom Keene against Democrat Rebecca Bennett, who has sought to capitalize on voters' frustration over the cost of living. More than half of those interviewed said they were either undecided or leaning toward Bennett. While grocery prices weighed heavily on many voters, complaints about Keene more often centered on his months-long disappearance from public view earlier this year, which he later attributed to depression. Their views on the economy mirror those of other Trump supporters Reuters has interviewed in recent months, who, despite standing by the president, say financial pressures have dampened their enthusiasm for voting in November. That ambivalence presents another potential challenge for Republicans and raises the stakes for the party's get-out-the-vote operation. Francesco Trebbi, a public policy professor at the University of California, Berkeley, recently co-authored research finding that Trump drew stronger support in the 2024 election in counties where inflation outpaced income growth, eroding households' purchasing power. With real wages rising only marginally and lacking the pace of broader economic growth, Trebbi said it is likely that that pattern will reverse in November. I expect the same anti-incumbent shift to happen in 2026, this time possibly weakening Republicans, he said, describing grocery shopping as a psychologically salient reminder of the squeeze on household finances. Each time one does it, it is the equivalent of a campaign ad against the incumbent. Trump support. To be sure, presidents have limited influence over inflation, which is driven by a range of factors and more directly addressed by the Federal Reserve. And many Republicans appear willing to give Trump the benefit of the doubt, even as his tariffs and the Iran war have contributed to rising prices. Bonnie Chandler, 64, plans to vote for Keene, saying she believes some companies were keeping prices elevated to make Trump look bad, and that the growing influence of the Democratic Party's progressive faction left her unwilling to consider its candidates. I'm going to vote Republican. I'm not a woke person. I'm not a communist. I'm not a socialist, she said. And that is all the time that we have for this last article entitled Grocery Issue Flips for Trump. That was by Nathan Lane. This concludes the first hour of the Arizona Republic for Sunday, August 16th, 2026. This has been Carrie, your volunteer reader with Sun Sounds of Arizona. Now, if you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org/broadcastinfo and audio/on-demand. You can take Sun Sounds with you. You can get our stream and on demand on our new Sun Sounds of Arizona app for Apple and Android phones. Now, please stay tuned for the second hour of the Arizona Republic.